finger. After an appropriate time, Shay's grandfather would lead Shay's mother, her brothers, her, and later Andon, inside, and the crowd of people would follow them in, and the whole sanctum would hum with their hushed voices and the throb of jade energy. Kal Sen was always front and center in the first row. His wife knelt on his left. To his right was Lon, then Hilo, then Shay, then Andon, once he was a Kal, then their mother. The service would drone on for hours. Learned ones, the most senior lifelong penitents, would lead the assembled worshippers in the recitations of exaltation for the deities, and then guide the meditation prayers concerning the attainment of the divine virtues. During the chanting, Hilo would fidget and make faces, and Kal Sen would glower at him. Shay's legs would go numb. She concentrated on ignoring Hilo. When she was older, she grew to find the services tolerable. Eventually, she realized the recitations were hopeful and calming. Deitism was a deeply Kekkonese faith. There were different sects, from the nationalistic to the pacifistic, but one thing they all agreed upon was that jade was a link to heaven, a divine but dangerous gift meant to be used piously and for good. Greenbones had to strive to be worthy people, virtuous people, people, Shay believed, like her grandfather. As a child, however, she didn't ponder spirituality. She thought about how much longer the ordeal would go on. When she slumped or leaned or groaned, her mother prodded her upright.
"Sit straight and be quiet," she admonished. "Everyone is watching you."
That had been her mother's entire philosophy of life. Sit straight and be quiet. Everyone is watching you. Well, no one was watching Shay now. Without a jade aura, she might pass any of her old academy classmates in the street and not even be recognized. When she'd gotten the phone call from the regional director of Standard and Croft Appliance, it had pleased her to know the job offer had been made in ignorance about her family. Yet she'd felt only a vague satisfied relief, not happiness, not enthusiasm. She had a graduate degree, her own apartment, and a job offer from an international company, one that any of her business school classmates in Aspenia would have congratulated her on. She was at last the independent, worldly, educated woman who'd risen above the savagery and insular nature of her jade and testosterone-fueled family. She was supposed to feel free and unencumbered, not lonely and uncertain. Shay bent her head. She wasn't sure if she believed in the ancestor gods, or in the banishment and return, or even in the idea that jade came from heaven. But every green bone knew that invisible energy could be felt, tapped, and harnessed. The world worked at a deeper level, and maybe if she concentrated hard enough, even without jade, she could communicate with it. "Guide me," she prayed. "Give me a sign." Chapter 31. Not According to Plan. Lon was in his study when the phone call came in from Hilo. It was on a line that was separate from the others. Only Hilo was aware of the number, and he knew to use it only for urgent matters that required an absolutely secure connection.
"I found the proof you wanted," the horn said, without preamble. "Doru's been in regular contact with the Mountain. He's been taking payment from them through secret accounts."
Lon felt a heaviness descend.
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure."
Reluctance kept the pillar silent for a second. "We'll handle this tonight, then." He looked at the clock. The workday was almost over. Doru would soon be leaving his office on Ship Street. There was no point in delaying. That would only spook the traitor and make the whole affair more painful for everyone. He made the necessary arrangements with Hilo, then hung up and sat quietly and gloomily for a few minutes.
The weatherman had recently returned from Igutan with information on the mountain's activities in that country, including details on its shine-producing facilities and business dealings. The fist and the finger that had been sent as Doru's bodyguards had watched him closely and reported no suspicious behavior on the part of the weatherman during the trip. Doru was not stupid. He knew he was on weak footing in the clan, and with Kal Sen's lucidity growing more unreliable by the day, it appeared he'd decided to hunker down and behave. He'd even gamely swallowed the insult of Lan suspending the KJA in his absence without consulting him. Even though Lan had mentally prepared himself for Hilo's call, the pleasant change in Doru's behavior had made him think, for a short while, that perhaps he'd been wrong about the man's compromised loyalties. He called Woon into his office. When the Pillarman arrived, Lan stood up to greet him. "You've been a friend to me for many years, and a good Pillarman for the last three," Lan said. "Starting tomorrow morning, you'll be weatherman of No Peak." Woon could not have been entirely shocked by the appointment, but he was still overcome with gratitude. "The clan is my blood, and the pillar is its master," he said, saluting deeply. "Thank you for this honor, Lan Chen. I won't fail you." Lan embraced him and said, "I've given you more responsibility for the past several months, and you've done well. You're ready." In truth, he was not entirely confident in his statement. He still felt Woon was not quite up to the caliber of a superior weatherman, but he was capable enough, and Lan held no doubt of the man's loyalty. In any case, there was no choice now. Woon had to step up to the task. "Not a word of this news to anyone until after I give you permission tomorrow." "I understand, Lan Chen," Woon said, with a proper somberness that showed he was perfectly aware he was coming into the role on account of another's misfortune. "These are difficult times for the clan. You'll have to be prepared to take control of the weatherman's office quickly. Go home early tonight and get a good night's rest, but let's have a drink together first." Lan took a bottle from his cabinet and poured them each a glass of hoji, which they enjoyed in muted celebration. After Woon had reiterated his thanks and departed, Lan went through his papers at his desk without truly paying attention to them. These days, he never felt as if he was at his best, either physically or mentally. The lingering weakness in his body heightened his constant anxiety over the threats to the clan, and now, knowing that the next 24 hours would be particularly difficult, made it hard to concentrate. An envelope sitting in an untouched stack of mail caught Lan's attention. When he extracted it, he saw that the return address was a postbox in Steppenland. A letter from Amy. Lan fingered the edges of the seal, eager and deeply reluctant to break it open. Since the divorce, they'd exchanged only a few letters, cordial and businesslike, settling affairs, her telling him where to mail belongings, that sort of thing. But seeing her handwriting, hearing her voice in his head, it never failed to bring down his mood. With what he already had to deal with today, he sighed aloud. She'd confessed the affair to him. One of Hilo's men had seen her entering an apartment building with her lover, and knowing her secret was lost, Amy had gone straight back to the house before the news could make its way through the horn back to Lan.
"Please don't kill him,"
she'd begged in a whisper, sitting on the edge of their bed with her hands squeezed between her knees.
"He's not Kekanese. He doesn't understand our ways. I'll stop seeing him and stay with you here, or I'll leave and you'll never have to see me again. Whatever you tell me to do, but please, don't kill him. And don't let Hilo kill him. That's all I ask."
And it was this heartfelt plea, driven by her obviously genuine fear, that saddened Lan the most. Because even after 5 years of marriage, she obviously didn't really know him at all. "Is he really such a better person than I am?" Lan asked dully. Amy looked up, eyebrows raised in surprise. Even distraught, her heart-shaped face had a genuine and unpretentious prettiness.
Of course not. But he's not the pillar of the great No-Peak clan. He doesn't cancel dinner plans. He doesn't travel with bodyguards. No one recognizes him or salutes him in public or stops him to ask for favors for their relatives. He can act silly and sleep late and go away on vacation at a moment's notice and do all the things we once did together.
You always knew I would be pillars someday, Lan reminded her accusingly. You understood it would be this way. There are plenty of women who'd be thankful, grateful, to be the wife of the pillar. You promised me that you were one of them. Aini's eyes filled with tears of remorse.
I was once.
I should make her stay, Lan had thought, with classic Kekanese vindictiveness. In exchange for this foreigner's life, she has to stay and give me an heir for the clan. In the end, he couldn't bring himself to be so cruel to either her or himself. The envelope in Lan's hand was square and stiff, like a greeting card. It looked thicker, like it contained a longer and more substantial message than previous mailings. He imagined opening it to find a letter in which Aini repented and begged him to take her back. Far more likely, with well-meaning heartlessness, she'd written to assure him that she was fine, to wish him well, and to tell him about her new home overseas and all the things she was seeing and doing with her boyfriend. Lan shut the letter in his desk drawer. In either case, this was not the right time to be distracted by melancholy thoughts of his ex-wife. He would open it later. And because it still taunted from inside the closed drawer, Lan got up and left the house. It was fifth day evening, and there would still be plenty of time to get back and await Hilo's phone call. Hours later, Lan did not, even after a meal and a lay at the Lilac Divine, feel considerably better. He sat on the end of the bed, finishing a cigarette and wringing a final few minutes of peace from the evening before he had to leave.
Is something wrong?
Yuni crawled up behind him and looped her bare arms around his neck, but he disentangled himself and stood up. He pulled on his pants, then walked into the bathroom with its scented candles and red lighting. He splashed his face with cold water, then took a hand towel from the rack and wiped down his neck and bare chest. From the bed, Yuni coaxed,
"Must you leave so soon? Come back to bed. Stay the night."
She'd like that. She'd make more money if he stayed. It would make up for the fact he'd been coming here less. "I'd like to be alone for a while now," he said, and because he couldn't bring himself to be unkind to her, "please." The charm girl's artfully polished facade faltered for a second. She crossed her arms over her breasts. He could sense her indignation at the dismissal. Who did he think she was? A street whore? Where was the sophisticated client she used to have? The one who enjoyed singing and harp music, conversation and wine? She recomposed herself admirably and stood up with unhurried grace.
"As you like, Kalchen."
Yuni gathered her robe around herself, slid her feet into slippers, and padded out the door, shutting it behind her firmly to announce her irritation. Lan didn't watch her go. He put on his watch and looked at the time. Right now, three fists were waiting to seize Yun Dorupan from the door of his favorite brothel in the sleazy coinwash district. The irony of how he and Doru were both spending the evening before their reckoning was not lost on Lan. After the fists picked up Doru, they would drive him to an undisclosed location. When they arrived, Hilo would call Lan at home. The fists were under orders not to hurt or kill Doru. Not yet. Not until Lan arrived. He'd been clear about this. He wanted to face the man he considered an uncle and ask him why After so many years of faithful service, he'd betrayed the clan. Then Lon would have to decide how to handle the weatherman's fate, so Khal Sen was never the wiser. As the inevitable hour drew closer, he felt unsure of his ability to do the right thing. Even now, knowing Doru was a traitor, he did not want to have the old man killed. He could still remember Doru returning from business trips with sweets for the Khal grandchildren. He was guilted by the image of Doru and Khal Sen playing chess in the courtyard. But betrayal so close, and at such a high level of the clan, it could not be forgiven. Was it possible, Lon wondered, to be both a strong leader and a compassionate person? Or were those two things opposing forces, pushing each other away? With the door closed and Yuni gone, Lon opened the combination safe and took out the rest of his jade. Another reason he'd stopped coming here as often. Taking off and putting on so much jade was painful now, like being dunked in ice and then coals, or physically shaken as if he were a bug in a jar. Lon fingered the beads around his neck, touching each one as if accounting for them, then put on the belt and cuffs, heavy and further encrusted with the jade he had won from Gom. He braced himself. A few seconds of delay, then the rush hit him hard, much harder than usual. The world tilted and folded. Lon's body screamed in protest, his chest seizing. He fell to the floor and clutched the carpet with curled fingers. "Breathe. Breathe. Get yourself under control." He fought back a moan. This was supposed to get better. The doctor had said that the damage Gom had inflicted was not permanent, but he still hadn't healed, and on-and-off symptoms of jade overexposure plagued him. The lingering injury from the duel, the increased jade load, general stress, and sleep deprivation, they were aggravating each other in a vicious cycle. Lon crawled onto the bed, reaching for his jacket hanging from the post of the headboard. He felt around until he found the rubber strip, vial, and syringe he'd tucked into the inside pocket and drew them out. The room seemed to be attacking him, the walls pressing in too close. His senses were wild, snapping in and out of focus. He caught a snippet of some angry conversation on the street outside as clear as if it were next to him. The next second it was gone, but the texture of the bedsheets was so prickly it stung his skin. Lon pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes and grasped for the control techniques he'd first learned in the academy, ones he hadn't needed since he was a teenager. He tensed, then relaxed every muscle in his body, slowly counting out the rhythm of his breaths until he'd pushed every feeling back to a tolerable distance and his hands no longer shook. Sitting on the pillow with his back against the headboard, he tied off his arm, uncapped the needle, drew the contents of the vial into the syringe, and hesitated. The shock and disbelief he'd seen on Anden's face filled his memory. So did the shame Lon had felt that day, knowing he'd profoundly damaged the young man's admiration and trust in him. Lon shared his cousin's disgust. He hated needles, and he despised SN1. He loathed resorting to it for the jade tolerance he'd always taken for granted. He was doing all he could to combat the manufacture and spread of the poison, and yet here he was, carrying a vial of it around with him, nestled against his chest like a tiny explosive. The agony of having to justify himself to Anden had caused Lon to go without an injection for days. He knew that wasn't how you were supposed to use the drug, but each time he waited as long as he could, thinking that finally he was getting better and no longer needed to resort to its use. And then the edginess, the perceptual distortions, the sweats and racing heart would start up once more. Tomorrow he'd go back to Dr. True, get checked over again, see if there wasn't something else he could do to hasten natural healing and build his tolerance back up to where he could carry his jade without chemical help. Perhaps he ought to take the risk of leaving Hilo in charge for a little while. A worrisome idea, but one that would allow him to get away to Morania for a week, where he could wear a little less jade and recover his health. Tonight, though, he couldn't be weak. He needed to be at his most clear-headed and decisive. There was no room to be mentally addled or emotionally volatile when you were sending a man to his death. Lan slid the needle into his vein and emptied the contents of the syringe into his arm. He untied the rubber tourniquet and closed his eyes. The drug circulated up into his brain, and in minutes cleared it like a television antenna, finally finding a signal and resolving flickering static into a clear image. Copious jade energy hummed through him, but it was steady and under control, waiting to be manipulated by his will. His senses were sharp as glass, but consistent and coordinated, no longer blasting in and out of focus. He felt good, powerful. He could leap to a second-story balcony or raise a deflection that would move a car. Lan allowed himself a moment of amazement. Despite his moral objections to SN1 and all it stood for, it truly was a remarkable drug. No wonder the foreigners wanted it so badly. No wonder Ait Mada wanted the fortune that could be made from selling it to them. Lan stowed the items back into his pocket, then finished dressing and let himself out of the room. In the lobby downstairs, he waved aside Mrs. Sugo's sugary inquiries as to whether he was satisfied with his visit, reassuring her that he was, but unfortunately could not stay to enjoy himself further. He had to get back to the house before Hilo called and someone else picked up the phone. Having sent Woon home and knowing the horn was occupied following his instructions, Lan had not bothered telling anyone he was going out for a few hours. He'd opted to take a cab and leave his car in the garage to avoid any attention. The drive to and from the Lilac Divine passed only through undisputed no-peak territories, so there was little danger. Outside, he flagged down another taxi and asked the driver to take him back to the house. Barrow's heart was hammering in his chest, but his hands were steady as he brought the Fullerton gun from the passenger side floor onto his lap and readied himself to fling open the door. The call had come from Moot half an hour ago, and the driver and car had appeared in front of his aunt's apartment building 15 minutes after that.
"It has to be tonight," Moot had said.
Everything was happening very quickly, but Barrow was fine with that. The sooner the better. There were two bouncers and several expensive cars parked in front of the elegant, dusky red facade of the Lilac Divine, but no silver Rowolf. Barrow spoke over his shoulder.
"You ready, KK?"
From the seat behind him, Cheeky made a nervous noise of assent. A man emerged from the Lilac Divine, a man Barrow would recognize anywhere. As he watched in astonishment, one hand on the door handle, Carl Lan, the pillar of the No-Peak clan, got into the back of a taxi. The taxi pulled into the street almost directly in front of them. Barrow was frozen for a second. Then everything fell into place for him. He spun forward in his seat to yell at the driver.
"Follow that cab! Come on, go! Drive!"
"What are you doing?"
Cheeky shouted, pulling his partly open door shut as the vehicle began moving.
"We're supposed to be shooting up the club. That's what they told us to do."
"Forget the fucking club,"
Barrow shouted back at him.
"Why do you think they sent us to shoot it up tonight? Because the fucking pillar of No Peak was there, that's why. Now he's in that taxi. He's who the mountain wants. There's no point in hitting the Lilac Divine if he's not there."
Barrow was not only certain of this, he was convinced that fate was shining on him at this instant, offering him the opportunity he'd been waiting for, something even better than what he'd been promised.
"This is it, KK," he said. "Our big chance."
"Do a good job. Make a big impression. Show just how valuable you can be to the clan." Those had been the goateed Greenbone's words. What could possibly make a bigger impression? What could be of greater value than taking out Carl Lahn himself? Barrow grinned, a little madly. It was not hard for him to call to mind the memory of Carl Lahn's dismissive, compassionate disdain. Tonight, the Pillar of No Peak would realize how badly he'd underestimated Barrow. Fate worked in mysterious and beautiful ways.
"Okay," Barrow hissed. "At the next stoplight, pull up beside the cab."
The driver was a lumpy-faced, heavy-set fellow who hadn't said a word all night. Either he was too dumb to be perturbed, or considered drive-by machine gun shootings to be unremarkable in his line of work. Who knew where Moot had found him? He didn't even respond now, merely shrugged at Barrow's direction and sped up to close the gap to the taxi.
"You're out of your mind, the fucking pillar of the No Peak Clan!"
Kiki's voice wavered on panic. He muttered,
"We're warm food, KK."
But still, he cranked down his window. They readied themselves to thrust the barrels of the Fullertons out the right-hand side of the car and open fire. It would be fast, very loud, and very messy. Lon noticed the black car following him. It wasn't the car itself he noticed first. From the distance of a city block, his heightened perception sensed the unmistakable hostility and fear directed squarely at him. Lon glanced over his shoulder and watched the vehicle take a turn after them, maintaining a two-car-length distance behind the taxi. He turned back around to face forward, then stretched out and focused his perception. Three men. The driver's energy was cool and dull. The other two were burning flares of excitable aggression and fear. No jade auras. Not Greenbones, then. Common criminals or hired grunts. Lon's mouth twisted. He removed cash from his wallet, enough to cover the cab bill and then some, and leaned forward, handing it to the driver. "This is far enough," he said. "Take a U-turn at the next light and drop me off at the corner. Then keep your head down and get out of here." The taxi suddenly shot ahead and spun into a U-turn.
"Shit, what's he doing?"
Barrow exclaimed. From the back seat, Cheeky said,
"He's on to us. He's getting out of the cab."
"Turn around!"
Barrow yelled at the driver.
"Turn around before he gets away!"
There was already traffic blocking line of sight between the two cars. The driver lost several seconds before taking a sharp turn up to the curb where Carl had gotten out. The taxi was already driving down the street, and the Greenbone was nowhere in sight.
Fuck!
Barrow opened the door and jumped out onto the sidewalk, swinging his head back and forth, trying to see where their target had gone.
"What do you think you're doing now?"
Cheeky hissed at him from the open car window.
"Carl's gone! We're not gonna chase after him on foot! Get back in before somebody sees you standing there holding a fucking fully gun! We can still go back to the club! Do the job they told us to do!"
He couldn't see Carl in either direction on the sidewalk. The street bordered a steeply descending embankment. Barrow ran to the railing and looked over, remembering in despair how fast Greenbones could move. The clumpy grass and dirt sloped down into darkness, all the way to the unlit pier where the silhouettes of small moored sailboats lined the edge of the harbor. Frustration welled behind Barrow's straining eyes. This was going all wrong, not according to plan at all. Then, miraculously, as if destiny had turned his face and made his eyes land on just the right spot, he saw a figure walking along the boardwalk by the water. It was too dark to tell for certain that it was Carl, but Barrow knew it was him. The set of his body, the way he walked, Barrow shouted in triumph.
I see him!
Cheeky cursed and scrambled from the car. He leaned over the railing and stared at where Barrow was pointing.
Forget it, KK. He's too far away now, and he already knows we're on to him. We'll get him another time. There won't be another time.
Call would get wise. He'd travel with bodyguards or change his routine. In any case, after this failure, the goateed greenbone would brush Barrow aside as unworthy, just another disappointing wannabe, and take away his chance at Jade. Barrow slung the strap of the fully gun over his shoulder and clambered over the railing.
Stay here if you like, he said. When I come back with Carl's head, I'll tell them what a thin-blooded coward you were. You better get out of town.
Cheeky was a pussy, just like Sampa, but the difference was that he couldn't stand to be called out on it. Barrow had figured that out early on. Barrow dropped to the other side of the railing and started sliding and scrambling down the hill as fast as he was able to with a heavy weapon weighing him down. He didn't look back once. He was sure Cheeky would swear a bit and follow him, and even if he didn't, Barrow didn't care. He wasn't going to give up and let his one golden chance slip away. The goateed greenbone had promised him a pebble of jade for gunning the lilac divine. But if he killed Carl Lahn, the pillar of the No-Peak clan, hell, Carl's jade was his by right. Greenbones took jade from the bodies of their enemies. Everyone knew that. Lahn had vaulted the railing and leapt lightly down the steep embankment to the empty wooden walkway that ran along the harbor. He straightened his jacket and walked, leaving his pursuers behind. He wasn't worried about them following. His perception was incredible, the strongest and clearest it had ever been. He could sense the confusion and disarray he'd left behind, and was sure the goons were not even professionals. They'd been hired to take a run at him. Lahn was almost insulted. He was also aggravated by the idea that he and his family might not be as safe inside No-Peak territory as he'd assumed. During foreign occupation a generation ago, Kekanese rebels had been masters of guerrilla fighting, sneak attacks, and constant low-level harassment. Hilo had told him about the organized thieving in the docks. The Mountain Clan was almost certainly behind it, and Lahn was sure this was part of the same thing. An ongoing effort to wear No-Peak down, to distract and overwhelm its leaders. Their enemies were feigning peaceableness, refusing to show themselves while hiding behind the activities of common criminals who were reckless and stupid enough to do their bidding. It had the makings of a patient war based on tactics that Ait Yu and Carl Sen would have approved of against Shatarians, but it was entirely counter to the tradition of open duel between greenbones in dispute with each other. It was offensive and disrespectful. It angered Lahn, and he could see why it infuriated Hilo. Perhaps he ought to go back and kill these men. He didn't have time for that, though, and he didn't want to create a scene that would slow him down right now. There were bigger problems to deal with tonight, and he was supposed to be in his study awaiting Hilo's call. Lahn walked faster. The boardwalk stretched all the way down near where the General's Ride passed under the KI-1 freeway. There, he could climb back up to street level and hail another taxi to take him home unmolested. He was nearly there when his chest began to hurt. It was a sudden, constricting pain, as if his diaphragm had been seized in a huge fist. Lahn slowed, alarmed, as he put a hand to his sternum. Nothing moved in the near darkness. The streetlight from the road above illuminated only the flat shapes of sampans and the masts of junks bobbing ever so slightly, the water slapping gently against their hulls. Lahn felt abruptly confused, as if he'd stepped from one place into an entirely different one through a door in a dream. He shook his head, trying to get his bearings back. What was going on? What was he doing here? His breaths were growing short and shallow, and he wondered why his heart was pattering irregularly. He was at the docks, trying to get home. He'd left the Lilac Divine, gotten into a taxi, been followed. That's why he'd left the cab and was down here. Why had it all escaped him so completely for a second back there? He took several more steps forward and staggered, unsteady on his feet. Something was wrong. A fog was descending over him, siphoning the clarity from his mind, the strength from his body. He felt warm and flushed, but when he put a hand to his brow, he found he was not sweating. His skin was fever hot and dry. These weren't jade-related symptoms. They weren't anything he'd experienced before. It occurred to him that perhaps he was having a stroke or a heart attack. Then the more obvious explanation struck him. The injection of SN1 he'd taken a few minutes ago. How many days had it been since his previous injection? 8? 9? After that long an abstention, he should have taken a half dose. He must have been distracted and rushed and taken a full dose instead. Lon tried to focus. He had to get to the street and find a phone right away. He'd taken the precaution of keeping SN1 counteractant in the house. He simply needed to get back there. He put one foot in front of the other, misjudging the distance to the ground and stumbling. His fists clenched. He could do this. He willed himself to. The street was not far, and he was a call. His father had once spent 3 days crawling through the jungle with a bullet in his back. Lon fixed his eyes ahead. He forced steadiness into his breath and took another step, then another. His mind cleared, his gait steadied. A noise behind him made him turn. Lon was astounded, not just by the fact that the two men, no, teenagers, from the black car had followed him, but that, in his state, they'd been able to sneak up to within 50 meters without him noticing. When he turned, the boys stopped, and a second of silent immobility passed. The taller youth on the right fumbled with the bolt of his Fullerton machine gun, but it was the sallow, crooked-faced teen on the left that made Lon stare in incredulity.
You!
They opened fire. A detonation of bewilderment and rage burst into Lon's skull. Enough! Enough with this! He brought his arms up, unleashing steel and deflection together in a massive expulsion of jade energy. The teenagers were not very good shots. Adrenaline and fear made them worse. Bullets tore up the wooden planks around Lon's feet, zinged into the air above, chopped into the hulls of boats, and even sent up rows of tiny splashes in the water. The ones that would have hit the pillar were caught up like flies in a blast of gale wind. Just as he'd taught Andon, Lon gathered them into the sucking wake of his deflection, whipped them around, and hurled them back out like a fistful of thrown marbles. They did not have the deadly speed and accuracy of bullets fired from a gun, but they were still dangerous. One of his attackers dropped the fully gun, clutching his arm. The other took lead to the knees and went down with a cry, his weapon clattering to the boardwalk. Lon was already moving, faster than shadow. Blazing with strength, he struck one gunman in the throat, crushing his windpipe before he hit the ground. He turned to the other youth, the one whose life he'd spared 6 months ago. The wounded teenager was trying to bring his weapon back up with his left arm. Lon tore the gun away, bent the barrel in his hands, and flung it aside. The boy scrambled backward, his face an open-mouthed white oval, as fear finally overtook reckless greed. "You want this, do you?" Lon held up the jade beads around his neck. "You think it's worth dying for? You think it'll make you someone you're not?" He reached to grab the fool by his hair and pull him forward to break his neck like a duck's, as Hilo had intended before. "You're stupid then. Too stupid to live." His hand closed on air as his legs suddenly buckled beneath him. Lon collapsed, his body engulfed in an agony of heat raging under the surface of his skin. The pain in his chest returned, redoubled, emptied his mind of thought. The teenager backpedaled, staring with wide, confused eyes. Then he turned and ran. His footsteps reverberated like cymbal crashes in Lon's hollow chamber of a skull. Lon didn't notice. He couldn't breathe. His mouth was dry. His throat was burning up. He needed to make it stop. Put out the fire. Fire was like jade and greed and war and unfulfilled expectations, consuming what it touched. Water. Get to the water. The world was dulling. He was crashing out rapidly now, as if his jade was being ripped away from him all at once. He felt frantically for the beads around his neck, the cuffs around his arms. He still had every stone. Get up, he urged himself. Keep going. He heaved himself back up and took a few more steps. Lon had once run lightly on thin beams across the academy's training grounds, but now he lost his balance and put a foot down too close to the edge of the pier. He pitched over, and when he hit the water, it was such an instant cold and silent relief that he didn't struggle when the silence closed over his head. Second Interlude: The One Who Returned. The most well-known scripture of the Deist religion, the Pact of the Return, is the story of a pious man named Genshu, who, a very long time ago, spoke out against the evils of a despotic king and was forced to leave his land. He packed his large family, including his younger brothers and sisters and their families, on a great ship and went in search of the fabled ruins of the original Jade Palace on Earth. After 40 years of sailing the earth, stopping but never settling, aided by some gods and hampered by others, surviving adventures that would form the basis for many myths in Kekkonese culture, Genshu and his clan arrived on a lush and unspoiled island. Impressed by his dedication and piousness, Yato, the father of all, spoke to Genshu, who was by now an old man, and led him into the mountains where he found stones of jade, the remains of the divine home once meant for humankind, a gift from the gods. While his family constructed a village by the shore, Genshu retired to a hermit's life of meditation in the mountains. Surrounded by jade, Genshu developed and mastered godlike wisdom and abilities, growing ever closer to a state of divine virtue. His grandchildren and great-grandchildren would seek him out to ask for his help, and he would emerge briefly from his isolation to settle disputes, quell earthquakes, beat back storms, and repel barbarian invaders. When he was 300 years old, the gods agreed that Genshu alone, of all their human descendants, deserved to be brought home to heaven. Devout Kekkonese deists consider themselves the descendants of Genshu and closest in favor to the gods. Greenbones who practice the religion today trace their way of life to Genshu's favorite nephew, Baijen, who went into the mountains to learn from his uncle and, after Genshu's departure from the earth, became the protector of the island's people, the first and fiercest jade warrior in island legend. While all Kekkonese revere Genshu as the one who returned, only Greenbones consider themselves close enough to his legacy to refer to him simply as Old Uncle. Upon Genshu's ascendance, the gods further proclaimed that when the rest of humankind followed Genshu's example and achieved the four divine virtues of humility, compassion, courage, and goodness, then they too would be welcomed back to godliness. All deists believe in this final promised occurrence, which they call the return. Chapter 32. the other one who returned. The phone call came before dawn, waking Shay on the morning of the day she'd expected to go to the family house for dinner with her grandfather and brothers. When she picked up the phone, she was astounded to hear Hilo's voice.
"Stay where you are," he said. "I'm sending a car to pick you up."
"Hilo?" For a second, she was not sure it was him.
"You have to come to the house, Shay."
"Why? What's wrong?"
The grogginess of sleep fled at once. She'd never heard Hilo sound near panic.
"Is it Grandpa?"
There was silence on the other end, so deep she might have heard her own voice echoing down a well. She squeezed the phone receiver.
"Hilo? If you won't talk to me, hand the phone to Lon."
Something in the pause that followed filled her with the truth a split second before she heard the words.
"Lon's dead."
Shay sat down. The phone cord pulled taut, and Hilo's words stretched thin as thread, barely reaching her from the other side of a vast gulf.
"They got him last night at the docks. Workers found his body in the water. Drowned."
She was staggered by the depth of her grief, the suddenness with which it arrived.
"Send the car. I'll be ready," she said.
She hung up and waited. When Hilo's large white Duchess Prisa pulled up in front of the apartment building, she walked out without locking the door or turning out the light. She got into the back seat. Meg Ken turned over his shoulder, sliding her a look of compassion so sincere she would have wept if it were not too early for that yet.
"I need to stop by the bank," she said.
Meg said,
"I'm supposed to take you straight home." "It's important. Hilo will understand."
Meg nodded and pulled the car away from the curb. She gave him directions to the bank, and when they arrived, he parked and got out of the car with her. He was loaded with weaponry, moonblade, talon knife, two handguns.
"You can't come into the bank like that," she said.
"I'll wait outside the door." The bank had just opened. Shay went in and requested access to her safe deposit box. The manager said,
"Of course, Miss Call, come with me,"
and showed Shay into the back room with its wall of small steel doors, then left her alone. Shay had not unlocked her safe in 2.5 years. When she turned the key and opened the box, irrational fear gripped her for an instant. What if it was not there? But it was. Her jade. All of it. Even before she reached inside, she felt the tug of its power setting off a tide in her blood, like the moon's gravity pulling on the ocean. She counted every stone as she put on the earrings, the bracelets up both her forearms, anklets, choker. Then she closed the safe deposit box door and sat down on the ground, her back to the wall, and hugged her knees to her chest. It had been so long since she'd worn jade that she felt the rush coming like the wave of a tsunami looming before it engulfs the beach. She did not tense or cringe from it. She raced alongside and let it sweep her up in its inexorable path. She rode it high, let it carry her simultaneously above her own body and more deeply inside it. She was inside the storm. She was the storm. Her mind spun in elated disorientation, the kind that comes from returning to an old house and opening the drawers, touching the walls, sitting in the furniture, remembering what was once forgotten. Guilt and doubt rose in opposition, then fell, carried swiftly away by the flood. Shay got up. She walked out of the bank and back to the Duchess with Make Ken. She got into the passenger side front seat, and Make asked,
"You want me to take you to the house now, Kaljen?"
Shay nodded. They did not speak during the drive. Shay's mind was being torn asunder so that her face and body did not know how to react. Someone observing her, such as Meg Ken, who occasionally slid a glance in her direction, would think that she was frozen, that she felt nothing at all. Lan being dead opened a chasm of desolation in Shay so vast she could not see the other side. Her eldest brother was the rock in the family, the one she felt she could always count on, no matter what. He had never been unkind or judging toward her, had always given his attention to her and respected her, even though she was much younger than he was. She wanted to be alone with the pain of her loss, but also could not help reveling in the rediscovery of her jade senses. The sense of euphoria in her own reclaimed power was inescapable, and it suffused her with a terrible remorse. All the while, another part of her was thinking clearly, if feverishly, toward vengeance. When they arrived at the house, she walked past the sentries and found Hilo standing in the kitchen, his hands leaning heavily on the table so his shoulder blades jutted up and his head seemed to hang between them. Like Make, he dripped with weaponry. He appeared in control of himself, almost thoughtful, but his jade aura heaved and roiled with the fiery consistency of explosive lava. Fists flanked him left and right, so the family kitchen was crowded with ferocious, waiting men, the collective aura clamor of their jade-adorned bodies assaulting Shay's reawakened sense of perception so much so that she paused to brace herself before entering. Elsewhere in the house, she heard Kianla quietly sobbing. Hilo raised his head to look at her, but didn't move.
"I'm going with you," she said. "I know where we should go."
Hilo straightened and came around the table toward her. She tried to see into his eyes, but they were as black and distant as she felt. The horn placed his hands on her shoulders, pulled her close, and laid his cheek against hers.
"Heaven help me, Shay," he whispered into her ear. "I'm going to kill them all."
Chapter 33. Down from the Forest. Gaunt Ash spent most sixth days at the Silver Spur cockfight pit and bar, which was owned by his cousin, a lantern man in the Mountain Clan. A longtime aficionado of the sport, Gaunt owned and played a dozen prize gamecocks that his nephew bred and trained for him. Right now, one of them was finishing off his opponent in a feathery melee of flapping, pecking, and flashing steel spurs. Excited shouts and disappointed groans rose from the bettors ringing the arena. Money exchanged hands as the referee lifted both birds, depositing the twitching loser in a blue plastic bucket and handing the victor back to his smiling trainer. The arena and seating took up the main level of the Silver Spur. The open second floor contained the restaurant and bar, where half the tables overlooked the action on the floor below, and those without a direct view could see the fights on the hanging closed-circuit televisions. In between watching the matches, Gaunt was having a late lunch and talking business with three of his fists when a messenger barged through the door and ran straight up the stairs to his table with the news. Kal Lan was dead, and Kal Hilo was coming here now to kill Gaunt himself. The horn was taken aback, but it didn't show on his face. Gaunt was an expert at keeping his thoughts and emotions to himself. Only his first fist, Wan Balu, noticed the small shift in his expression, a flaring of the nostrils, the tightening of his mouth into a skeptical scowl. Gaunt looked around himself. He was in a building in the South Wallows, deep inside mountain territory, in broad daylight, surrounded by several of his greenbone warriors. Was Kal really so insane as to try to attack him here? Gaunt decided he was.
"Call every finger you have nearby," he demanded of his fists. "Clear the people out of here. Send lookouts to either end of the street and guard the doors."
His men scrambled to obey. Gaunt found his nephew and told him to take their valuable birds out the back door and far away. The owner of the Silver Spur refused to flee with the customers, so Gaunt made him and his staff lock themselves in the kitchen with a pair of shotguns pointed at the door. The battle to come would be bloody. The second Kaal son was a heavily jaded and ferocious fighter, and for all the mountain's internal assertions that no peak was in decline, Gaunt knew that it was still a formidable clan with committed young warriors. After the failed assassination attempt and the duel at the factory, Ait Jen had instructed everyone to be more careful, more focused on the mountain's eventual goal. So Gaunt had not expected a violent showdown so soon. As much as he looked forward to separating Kaal Hilo's head from his body, he wondered what had gone wrong, why their plans had failed. No time for speculation now. Green bones filled the Silver Spur and its surrounding streets. In a few minutes, Gaunt had a total of 14 men in and around the building, 3 fists and 11 fingers. They took up positions near the door and in the upstairs windows. Half a dozen more jade warriors were gathering down the street in the mountain-owned Brass Arms Hotel, where they would close in behind the No Peak fighters and attack from the rear. Gaunt expected No Peak would outnumber them, but this was mountain turf, and he held the advantage of ground. He considered phoning his pillar, but decided against it. Reinforcements would not arrive in time, and besides, he intended to meet and kill Kaal Hilo himself. The ruse was Shay's idea. Before she'd arrived at the house, Hilo had been ready to head straight into the heart of mountain territory to kill Gaunt and as many of his men as he could. He'd already drunk a shot of Hoji and cut his tongue on a knife with his fists, the traditional green bone ritual before undertaking a mission one expected not to return from. She faced him down across the kitchen table the way she used to when they were children.
"We have to be smarter than that. If we die today, the mountain wins."
They had to think ahead, even in this terrible time.
"Gaunt will be ready and waiting for us. Even if we kill him, we won't defeat the mountain, won't destroy it."
Perhaps this unfettered outburst of emotion, surging Shay's jade aura with a vehemence that Hilo could not ignore, forced the horn back into thinking clearly. He looked at his most trusted senior fists and saw some of them nodding at what Shay had said. He turned to her.
"I wish to the gods it hadn't taken this to bring you back," he said. "But you're green, and one of us again. So tell me what you have in mind."
Once she explained her idea, he smiled with a cold, satisfied determination and seized upon it with as much conviction as if it had been his own. He gave quick orders to his men, sprang to carry them out. While the Make brothers organized the attack parties, Shay went to the armory room behind the training hall to find herself some weapons. When she returned, Hilo was sitting on the stairs with Wen, saying goodbye. Their heads were bent close together, and they were speaking quietly. Wen's eyes were dry, but her fingers trembled as she smoothed Hilo's hair behind one of his ears with a tenderness that made Shay turn away, feeling like an intruder witnessing a private moment. She went to stand outside and watch as the Duchess and 5 other cars departed the estate. The convoy of vehicles would be sighted entering the low street tunnel, and word would reach Gaunt Ash that Kaal Hilo was on his way to seek a showdown at the Silver Spur. The mountain would rush to mount a defense while the Duchess-led convoy took its time circling the Wallows district before returning to No Peak territory. Seconds after the decoy cars exited the roundabout of the Kaal house, the Makes and 3 other fists pulled up in nondescript vehicles hastily borrowed from a nearby lantern man's car dealership. Hilo came out. Gone was the gentleness Shay had glimpsed earlier. He strode down the front steps, then turned to face the house. There he fell to his knees and touched his head to the concrete. The horn rocked back and raised his face to the sky.
"Can you hear me?"
he bellowed, and Shay was not sure who he was screaming at. His troops, the window of their grandfather's room,
the departed spirit of their slain brother, or the gods themselves.
Can you hear me? I'm ready to die. The clan is my blood, and the pillar is its master.
Shay had always strongly disliked Hilo's penchant for dramatic